Almost 3 weeks ago, as isolation at home tightened its grip on many of us, Netflix released the documentary series Tiger King. It seemed to capture a binge-ready audience at just the right moment, and it's been burning up social media channels ever since.
Tiger King tells the story of a man who calls himself Joe Exotic, who bred and exhibited big cats and other animals in a sketchy private zoo. Joe is now in prison, convicted of hiring someone to kill an activist named Carol Baskin. She had tried to shut down his business and became his nemesis. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Linda Holmes. We're talking about the Netflix phenomenon Tiger King today on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR, so don't go away.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With Capital One, a new savings account earns 5 times the national average. That's 5 times more savings toward that overdue home addition, or maybe even an addition on that addition. Capital One is helping you earn more towards your savings goals. This is banking reimagined. What's in your wallet? Capital One N.A. Member FDIC.
Welcome back. You just met NPR Music's Stephen Thompson, also with us from his bunker out in Virginia, is Glenn Weldon of the NPR Arts Desk. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, all you cool cats and kittens.
So just to set this up a little bit more, there's actually been some coverage of this story prior to this. There's a podcast out of Wondery called Joe Exotic, the Tiger King. There is also a very thorough article in the Daily Beast. There's a thorough article in Vulture if you want to seek those out. I think you'll get a slightly kind of deeper dive than you surprisingly enough get from this long documentary series. You spend a lot of time in this series meeting various people who are associated with this Joe Exotic dude, not only Carol Baskin, but also her now husband, the people who work or worked with Joe at the zoo, which is called the GW Zoo. So to kind of try to find a way into this, I'm going to go to Glenn first. I sense that this is probably not a Glenn Weldon special.
I'm going to be a stick in the mud here. I'm going to be a humorless prig with a G. I don't get this thing. I don't understand why it's so popular now, because at a time when my faith in humanity is at its lowest ebb, this just came in and sucked it dry. And I think I was not prepared for it, right? The memes and the tweets are so gleeful about this thing. It led me to believe that this would be Duck Dynasty with tigers. Now, granted, I never watched Duck Dynasty because it belonged to that subset of reality programming, which is get a load of these weirdos. And, you know, that's just not me. Like, if it's Kardashians, Housewives, Jersey Shore, I don't think I have the emotional distance. I just end up getting depressed. So I was depressed. Add to that the belligerence of Joe Exotic turned me off, the animal cruelty. And also, not for nothing, I don't understand these people. Everybody on the show keeps making the same assertion over and over again, which is everybody wants to pet a baby tiger. What? No, that is not a thing. I never found Joe Exotic interesting or compelling. And I'll shut up now, but I'll just close by saying, just as for Carol Baskin, this show does her so dirty. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a second. Stephen, I want to go to you. I didn't quite have the confidence that I did with Glenn that you would hate this, but what did you think of it?
My stick tends not to be stuck quite so squarely in the mud as Glenn's. I shared some of Glenn's misgivings. I wasn't quite as repulsed by the actual show itself. I think as a piece of entertainment, I found it engrossing. I sped through 5.5 hours pretty quickly when you consider how repellent so many people on this show are. I think where the show falls down for me as a viewing experience is I tend to like to find somebody to latch on to, somebody to root for, somebody to feel for. And other than Saf Safari, who worked at Joe Exotic's zoo, I didn't really find anybody particularly rootable as a human being. And so it really does wind up being 5.5 hours of, as Glenn said, get a load of these weirdos. I actually wrote get a load of these weirdos in my notes before Glenn said it. So I think the biggest issue for me probably is in presenting repellent behavior as quirk. I found that very frustrating over time. But I also understand how this show slid off the rails a little bit as a piece of storytelling. These people are weirdos. You know, at one point, kind of late in the series, we meet a character and he's talking and he's like, well, you know, of course, I was already in trouble because of my black market lemur. And you're just like, oh, okay, I'd like to actually know a little bit more about the black market lemur. And you know, so I think it's very easy for a show like this to kind of follow these wackadoo storylines that keep popping up, and then you kind of lose sight of this larger story about animal cruelty and the cult-like atmosphere at these zoos. I mean, there's an enormous amount to unpack. They're just covering a lot of people you don't really actually want to spend time with.
Yeah, if any of us were going to sort of appreciate this as some feat of wacky television making, I would probably be the most likely candidate. I have watched a lot of true crime documentaries. I've listened to a lot of true crime podcasts. For me, I just didn't think it was made very well. I didn't think it was structured very well.
Right.
I don't think the people who made it understand how to build a series of episodes. I think it kind of is a bunch of stuff mushed together. For a story like this, you have to have kind of a coherent direction, but then each episode also has to have a internal structure to it. I don't think it succeeds at that level. And I think one of the reasons why it's not successful is that it is, for me, bending over backwards to redraw this story as something other than what it is. Because if you read, for example, the Daily Beast piece, or you read the New York Magazine piece, the story they are telling, and obviously my knowledge of this is only as good as the reporting, but the story that they are telling is essentially that Carol Baskin was trying to get the GW Zoo closed down. She went to great lengths to stop him from doing these cub petting things where he would take tiger cubs out and people would pay to pet them and have pictures taken with them. And then eventually he got very angry and upset and tried to have her killed. That's the story that they are telling in those pieces. The story in the Netflix series is kind of, it has a real gendered ickiness to it in terms of like woman as buzzkill and woman as black widow. There's a weird kind of completely evidence-free assertion made that she had some involvement in the disappearance of her first husband. I don't think there's a shred of evidence that's presented to support that, but they spend a whole episode on it. Mm-hmm. And it feels like an effort to rebalance this story. So I think the reason it doesn't work narratively is that it's not built on anything. So I think the fact that I didn't find it persuasive and the fact that I didn't find it well-made are linked. And for a lot of people, Joe Exotic has emerged as some kind of appealingly quirky character. I don't find him that way at all. I think that's how he wants to be perceived. Mm-hmm. I find him to be rather loathsome because of the animal cruelty things that he essentially admits to in terms of how he handled the tigers that he had. Uh-huh. There are a lot of allegations that he was abusive to the staff that worked at this GW Zoo. I just didn't buy into this kind of image of him as a wacky, entertaining figure.
Right. I said earlier that I didn't understand why it was happening now, except the fact that we're all home and we have to watch something. I do have a theory. I have a feeling that the central dynamic of this show is a very familiar one. And so it might be comforting to some people. You know, it's competent, middle-aged, blonde woman who gets dinged for not expressing emotion in the way society deems she should, versus a highly emotional, bellicose, self-aggrandizing man with weird hair, right? I mean, we've seen this before. We've lived through this. And his loathing of Carol Baskin is not built. It's not shaped. It is just asserted over and over again. It doesn't go anywhere. So what we end up doing is watching him fire off theory after theory, and he eats up all that airtime so that his theories get added this kind of emotional weight that they probably shouldn't have. It's frustrating. Ultimately frustrating.
Yeah.
The presentation of him as like a quirky oddball. I mean, I totally understand. They have access to these weird music videos that he did that are so weird and so eccentric. I understand leaning on that as a, wow, get a load of this weirdo. But at the same time, it does wind up kind of casting him as a folk hero. And this show does put its thumb on the scale in some really frustrating ways. Setting aside the kind of hard copy style reenactments that this show occasionally does, mm-hmm. the tendency to have an interview where the person says what they're there to say, and then the camera holds on their kind of unblinking face for like an extra beat or two. When they do that, it tends to be presented as like there's something weird or off or staged about or dishonest about what this person has just said. And that may or may not be true. When you're doing interviews like this, part of your process is you hold for a second after you do that interview. Mm-hmm. This is a very subtle thing, but it felt very dishonest every time they did it. You're interviewing Carol Baskin, she says something, and then you're almost frozen on her blank expression. And it's like she's doing that for the benefit of the filmmakers.
Yeah.
And it's being right. turned on her to make her look like more of a weirdo. That kind of thing I found really, really frustrating.
One thing just from a filmmaking perspective that I think this desperately needed was someone who seemed like a reliable narrator. Mm-hmm. They certainly treat Carol Baskin as an unreliable narrator. Joe Exotic is presented very much as an unreliable narrator. Just about everyone is. And very often in a story like this, you'll get a journalist, an investigator, an attorney, somebody who gives you a sense of what's the center of this, like what is the truthful center of this story. And that character, although it can seem kind of talking heady and all that stuff, that character can help keep you grounded within the story. And it's one of the things that helps assemble things with some kind of through line so that you don't feel like you're just wandering from incident to incident. I share with Glenn and Steven this sense that I'm very uncomfortable with some of the get a load of these weirdos kind of stuff that goes on. It's heavily classed in a way that I think is, you know, some of the pointing and giggling at Joe Exotic feels classed because he is somebody who for much of his life, according to his own telling of his story, was very poor. But there's also something very classed in the way that they try to present Carol Baskin as a culturally elite, like maybe she's more snobby. And if you read about her story is not that really. But I think they're trying to set up a class conflict between these two people that doesn't really feel like it's genuine. So I think the only places where this story is engaging with class, it's doing so in a way that doesn't feel honest to me. I felt the same way about the fact that Joe is gay and has had a series of husbands, a couple of them at the same time, most of them much younger than he is. According to some accounts, young men who were vulnerable when he met them. But the only places they really engage with that, it feels like the fact that he's gay is being used to make him sympathetic, if that makes sense.
It absolutely does. It's an attempt to make him sympathetic. And there's also a weird delight that the show takes in his queerness that I don't think is earned. I mean, it seems to me as if the show feels like it has discovered the concept of trade, you know, straight guys doing gay stuff for goods and or services. And it didn't discover it. It's been around for a long time. It also, you know, it gets a lot of the queer stuff wrong. It misgenders Saf, and you know, it doesn't even raise the issue of gender fluidity at all. It's I don't know, again, the word of the day is frustrating.
I just don't think it's well made, and I think it invites you to kind of scold it for being, you know, salacious and all that stuff. I just don't think it's very good filmmaking.
I think there's clearly something compulsively watchable about this show. It's enormously popular. Like I said at the top, I blazed through 5 hours really quickly. You know, it's a digestible show, but I think that formlessness is part of the issue. Like, I think that the attention of the filmmakers seemed to wander in the way that the attention of an audience member might wander, like where you're just kind of seeing this weirdo and it's like, what, her husband disappeared? What's that? And then the story is kind of like, okay, well, here's an episode where her husband disappears. But it's sort of following instead of leading, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. It does make sense. Yeah, I was kind of surprised because I'm often up for a kind of strange, crazy crime story, and this just did nothing for me. And I have the benefit of coming at this as something that by the time I watched it was already kind of a phenomenon. And I think when that happens, you have a different reaction to it. You're judging it against whether you understand why it's a phenomenon rather than is there any reason anyone would find this interesting, which is what I think a lot of the initial reactions were. So I'm not shocked by anybody who found it interesting. It just didn't hit for me. It did not do anything for me. But I am curious to hear from those of you who have seen it. Tell us what you thought of it. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet us at PCHH. Before we go, we wanted to bring you a little something extra. We are not able to book our guests the normal way right now. So we asked our very beloved fourth chairs to send us a little bit of tape of what's making them happy this week, because we know that you guys can always use some extra happy and we can use some extra happy. So hopefully on Wednesdays, we'll be bringing you some extra recommendations. And our first one, fittingly enough, comes from our dear Kat Chow. Take it away, Kat.
What's making me happy these days is the novel Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reid. It is so good. It is so smart and searing and funny and thoughtful. And it tackles so many different themes in a way that I just haven't read in a novel in a long time. Basically, the premise is there's a 20-something young woman living in Philadelphia. She's Black. Her name is Amira. And she's a babysitter for this wealthy white family. And at the very beginning of the book, this doesn't give anything really away, an incident happens at a grocery store where someone accuses her of trying to steal or kidnap this child because they don't believe that, you know, she is their caretaker. And this incident is the crux of the story in that it creates a lot of dynamics that kind of propel the story forward. At the same time, it reveals so much about race and class and just, you know, like quote unquote good white people. And Kylie Reid still manages to give so many of her characters joy and make them so real and so dynamic in a way that I think is really difficult to pull off. So I highly recommend this book. It brightened so many of my days. So that's what's making me happy.
Hi, this is Nadu Ulubi, correspondent for the Arts Desk here at NPR. And I am someone with a dark side. I am an unreconstructed, unapologetic horror movie fan. So what's making me happy this week is The Platform. It's a Spanish horror film on Netflix, and it's one of those socially conscious horror movies. This one is obsessed with class inequality. The conceit is absolutely bonkers. People are imprisoned in this weird tower that's like a jail, but it's hundreds of floors, with a gourmet kitchen on top, where they prepare sumptuous banquets, and the meal gets laid out on a platform that slowly descends from floor to floor. So the prisoners on the highest floors are literally the top of the food chain. And as the platform descends, there's fewer and fewer scraps of food left on the platform. So people on the lowest floors are at their worst trying to survive. The platform is gorgeous, the acting's great, and it's ultimately a positive movie about the power of collective action. People online have been arguing endlessly about it, especially its wonderfully mysterious ending. And I just want to say that I love any movie that contains the super serious line,
La panna cotta es el mensaje.
The message is the panna cotta.
All right, so Kat recommended the book Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reid. Netta recommended The Platform, now streaming on Netflix, which, by the way, Glenn has also recommended on this show.
Sure have.
And that brings us to the end of our show. Thanks to both of you guys for being here, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And of course, thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. If you have a second, subscribe to our newsletter. It's at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. We'll see you all right back here on Friday.
Right now, every household in the country is being asked to fill out the U.S. Census. It's the form that helps us determine how voting districts are redrawn, where to build public schools and hospitals, how to spend federal money. So why are some people afraid to fill it out? We're getting into all that this week on NPR's Code Switch podcast.